Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Welcome to this week's episode of Anchorage Edition. I'm Jill Burke, filling in for Michael Carey. Joining us today are Steve McDonald, news director at KTUU, Lori Townsend, news director with Alaska Public Radio Network, and by phone, Libby Casey, Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Radio Network. Thanks for joining us, everybody. As always, a very busy week in Alaska news this week. Perhaps topping headlines is the story about a case of domestic terrorism that was busted right in our own backyard by federal agents in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about who these people are, how they found them, and what they were threatening to do?
Yeah, this was a very surprising story. It was just kind of told to us through an email, a news release, I should say, and we went off to the news conference that was held by the U.S. Attorney and the FBI. Paul and Nadia Rockwood, who reside out in King Salmon, are charged with making terroristic threats. They've allegedly compiled an enemies list, basically a hit list of about 15 people, all from outside. It may not all be people, too. It may also be some facilities that may be included in there as well. But they allegedly, according to the FBI that investigated the case, made up this list of 15 targets for assassination. And this list was delivered by Mrs. Rockwood, allegedly, to someone here in Anchorage. It's not real clear whether it was delivered to an undercover agent or this person who received the list then gave it to the FBI, but it wound up into the hands of the FBI. And then it began its investigation and then arrested these two who have worked out a plea deal with the U.S. Attorney's Office. If it's approved by a federal judge, Mr. Rockwood would go to prison for, I believe, 6 years. Mrs. Rockwood, who is a resident of Great Britain, would basically be deported. She's also five months pregnant on this. So we don't know what the targets, who they are or what they are, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions, too. But they're due to be sentenced, I believe, next month.
So King Salmon's a fairly remote community, pretty small. I think the gentleman was a weatherman there,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yes.
What do
National
we know about Service. Them? I mean, they seemed fairly unassuming in appearance, mm-hmm. from their mug shots that came over.
They did. From the accounts that I've read about the couple, they were the Ward and June Cleaver of King Salmon because they were very involved in their community. They helped people, and Nadia was involved in fundraisers for local events. And then they left King Salmon and moved into Anchorage in the last several months and told people in King Salmon that they were planning to go back to England, where Nadia has dual citizenship here in the U.S. and in England, and they were planning to go back there where her mother is. And there's so much that's unknown. It's a very strange case that they, on the one hand, seemed like a very normal family, have one small child, and as Steve mentioned, another on the way. And yet this comes out about their alleged involvement in creating this list of 15 people and possibly places, mm-hmm. to attack.
And do we know anything about how the husband and the couple developed and first became exposed to kind of his extremist Islamic loyalties?
When they lived in Virginia, I believe it was, they started out in Virginia, he converted to Islam. And over time, began following a cleric who is who has some anti-American beliefs, and I believe some ties to Al Qaeda as well. And so, this is something that began to form early on, and then seemed to, come to a crescendo out here in King Salmon. But, Lori is right. He worked as a weatherman. He worked some odd hours, wasn't seen a lot in the community, but she was fully involved, it sounds like, in the community. As you said, fundraising. She was also involved in a theater group. This is always when somebody commits some sort of an act against society. You always kind of hear the proverbial, such a quiet person and such a normal couple. And you're hearing it in this particular case as well. You know, people are just kind of astounded out there in King Salman that these folks would be allegedly involved in something like this. So, yeah, they did blend into the community very well.
Well, and unrelated, but earlier in the week, Sarah Palin got involved in another kind of extremist battle with the mayor of New York City over a mosque that is slated to go up near the 9/11 site. Lori, why don't you tell us what started there and how it kind of got off course on the main argument?
It definitely got off course. More has been made of the fact that Sarah Palin tweeted a word, refudiate, asking peaceful Muslims to refudiate the idea of a mosque near Ground Zero in New York, and much was made of that, of the creation of a word, and Ms. Palin then compared herself to Shakespeare, saying Shakespeare liked to coin new words, and so you have to celebrate that I did this, and so a lot's been made of that, and not much has, it's kind of ran over the initial argument that started when Palin put out this request to Muslims to reject this idea of a mosque, and Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg's aide, an aide of his, tweeted back saying, mind your own business, and accused her of being racist. Bloomberg has said he doesn't think that she's a racist, but he also says, I don't agree with Sarah Palin on everything, I don't agree with my aide on everything, but she has the right to say what she'd like to, and so it's kind of grown on its own over this Shakespeare reference.
Right, the new Twitter phenomenon of Shakespalins, I believe, which some of them were very, very funny. A lot of people had a lot of fun with it. But so, Steve, where do the two sides sit? We have Bloomberg's not backing down. Palin hasn't conceded. They're kind of just camped out.
They agree to disagree. Yeah, he says, you know, constitutionally, they have the right to build a mosque. And he says it's a freedom of speech, freedom of religion issue. She says, you know, let's have some decency. Let's not build this thing. Let's reconsider. So, yeah, I think the two sides have just dug in their heels, and this is one of those issues that they're going to agree to disagree. There is no real middle ground on this and all. And I feel bad for Don Young. He's been making up words for years and never compared himself to Shakespeare, so he needs to maybe step up a little bit. But she's definitely, you know,
stepped in and kind of taking
over some of his tradition there, making up words.
Okay. Another big story this week was the possible rumor that BP Alaska might be looking to offload some of its Alaska holdings to help raise money in this distress sale to cover some of the costs affiliated with its spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Those at the beginning of the week proved not to be true. However, late at the end of this week, we're hearing maybe those talks still exist. Lori, what went down and which company was involved?
Well, it's a company called Apache that's based in Houston, and they have a reputation, I understand, of being an outfit that can go into poorly performing fields and sort of reinvigorating them and getting them to produce more. And they were in talks with BP. We'd heard market speculation that perhaps Alaska was involved, Prudhoe Bay was involved, and then that turned out to not be the case, at least at this point. They're buying $7 billion worth of assets from BP. BP's trying to raise $10 billion right now. So they still have other assets that they'll possibly put up for sale. Part of what may have been in play with Apache and Prudhoe Bay, if it was part of the discussion, is the fact that it's not just BP that's involved with the ownership of that field, of course. It's also ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, to a lesser extent, Chevron. And so there are other partners that would have had to have been involved in how these discussions would have went. Maybe that proved too complex for Apache, it's hard to say. But BP says at this point that they need to raise $10 billion. We know that the White House has requested a $20 billion fund for compensation for lawsuits that are sure to be coming and have already been filed in some cases. The cleanup who knows what that will cost and how long that will take and how long the lawsuits will be coming in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it remains to be seen if they will have to look at raising money beyond the $10 billion and how they'll carry that out, and if Prudhoe Bay might at some point still be up for sale.
And Steve, we're hearing today that maybe there are some negotiations again with BP Alaska over Prudhoe Bay.
Right.
Do we know if it's any of the existing owners that are also up there that might be interested, trying to exercise some of their right of first refusal?
I haven't heard that myself, so, and that certainly is a possibility. BP has had has done this in the past, though, too. At least two other occasions in the past, it sold off a portion of its Prudhoe Bay holdings for various reasons. So this isn't something that is unprecedented. And as Laurie said, you know, they've raised the $7 billion in the sale to Apache, and they need a few billion more. So I imagine that there are still going to be talks about how to raise that money, and a portion of Prudhoe Bay could be involved.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if any other companies are involved in this.
Another move today related to the Gulf spill and oil and gas development on the North Slope is a decision by a federal court to block lease sales in Area 193 in the Chukchi Sea. Lori, what do we know about that, and what does it affect, if anything, immediately?
Well, that's a little bit unclear. Shell doesn't know if they will be able to do anything now. They had plans to do some work up there, even though things were sort of on hold even before this decision came down. But they had gotten the go-ahead to do some certain activities, and their spokesman the other day, Curtis Smith, said he doesn't know what that means, if they'll be able to proceed with anything at this point. But Judge Beislein did put on hold that lease sale because he said MMS, the former MMS, which is now the Bureau of Ocean Energy and Management, Beislein said that they had not looked at, they didn't know enough about the environmental impacts, and they had not determined whether or not the information that was missing was important, and if they could get it without it being an exorbitant cost or taking too much time. That's the criteria that they have to use, and they didn't make that determination. So Beislein essentially said, you haven't done enough homework, and you need to determine what's missing, how important it is to your decision making, and whether or not you can realistically get this information, and then justify it if you cannot. That was one point. The other point was the fact that they had only looked at oil impacts, the exploration and development of oil, and not gas. And Beislein said, you have to gauge those impacts as well. The leases are for both oil and gas, and there are incentives in the leases for developing both. And so he said, you have to go back and figure this out.
So we have Shell that's waiting now on the outcome of this challenge, to the successful challenge to the lease sale, waiting on an outcome on the moratorium and the shallow water drilling decision, as well as the review of whether those kinds of activities are adequate in the Arctic or allowable, you know, I guess safe, risk, the risk
minimized.
Is low enough to make it worth it. Libby, are you hearing anything in your circles about how the delegation is responding to any of these situations?
No, I know. Begich has come out and said repeatedly that he wants to make sure that his party, you know, the Democrats, President Obama, don't go too hard on the producers on the North Slope and of course, offshore drilling. So they're just trying to keep pushing and pushing and making sure that that whatever happens in the Gulf because of the BP blowout, it doesn't affect the offshore situation too much. But, you know, Begich is trying to make sure that his ideas for oil spill legislation get included in what's happening nationally. So is Senator Murkowski, and their number one thing is trying to kind of parse those two things apart. Okay, there's the deep water drilling in the Gulf. Let's try to make a distinction between what could happen up in Alaska.
Okay. And Senator Murkowski is also not just dealing with matters in Congress, but she's working for re-election as well, so she's been busy. Things are heating up with her and her challenger, Joe Miller. Tell us about where that stands.
Well, of course, Senator Murkowski has a lot more money on hand than Joe Miller. We found this out from their campaign report. She's got about $2.4 million compared to his $125,000. And so we may see, you know, this really play out in the next couple of months as we head to that August primary when they blast the airwaves with more and more ads. Miller has this Tea Party Express group that's supporting him, and they're still saying they're going to put up to $1 million into that race, so that'll be a separate pot of money that they'll contribute. But these money numbers are important because it just sort of shows, I guess, sort of who's going to be able to flex their muscle. Both groups are pointing the finger and saying outside interests are contributing. So the fingers are going both ways. And the Tea Party, of course, had its own drama this week when the group calling itself the Larger National Federation booted this Tea Party Express. That's a group that's supporting Miller because one of the Express guys, Mark Williams, had this satirical blog posting that was widely considered racist and in poor taste, but the Express would not disavow him, and so that larger group booted it. The question we all had was, what does this mean for Miller's campaign and their relationship with the Tea Party Express? And Miller's folks said they don't consider this to be a distraction. They don't see the Express as being racist. They're separating the Express from what Mr. Williams did. And just today, Williams said he's completely cutting ties with that group. So they're trying to do some distancing, but the damage may already be done there.
Steve, what's your assessment of this race so far, kind of where we're at with ads and jabs and money?
Yeah, we haven't really, we haven't really seen a big ad war just yet. We've seen Lisa Murkowski come on and remind everybody, you know, that she's the sitting senator and what she's doing in Congress. We haven't really seen a whole lot from Miller. I think we're going to see a huge radio campaign here pretty soon. That's what they touted at this news conference. So we'll hear a lot more from him coming up. You're going to hear a lot of things about Murkowski not truly being a conservative. You know, she's a member of the Republican Party, but she's not a conservative. She's aligned more with the Democrats. That's what you're going to hear from the Miller camp on this. And she's really aligned herself with the party on just about every issue. The Elaine Kagan nomination to the Supreme Court, she's just come out against that pretty much along party lines. Unemployment benefits extension, she was against that as well, again, pretty much along party lines. And part of it, too, is that she has really has risen up in the leadership ranks of the Republican Party and the United States Senate. So, you know, she does have to follow their list of, you know, their stances on issues. She can't really stray too far from the party line, but she's definitely trying to show that she has some conservative lineage there, and she's not aligned with the Democratic Party. She definitely was, when she was a member of the state legislature, she was definitely more centrist than she is right now.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm. Libby, we're going to talk to you again here. It's been a busy week in Washington, D.C. with some key legislation. I guess we'll start with the energy bill. Our senators are rather lukewarm on it. Tell us why.
That's right. Well, yesterday, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, Harry Reid, said, yep, we have to abandon the attempt to get a climate change bill, a big climate change bill, passed this summer. So what we're going to see now is something very scaled back that really just focuses on the situation in the Gulf, the BP blowout, and also some minor energy components. I mean, we're talking about things like incentives for natural gas use and Homestar energy programs, things like that. Senator Begich, I talked to him about this last night, and he said he's basically disappointed that this isn't a broader reaching bill. He said, you know, to be frank, it's not the robust, comprehensive plan I was hoping to see. But he says some of the things in it he may support. He wants to see the details, though. Reid will actually introduce the bill next week, and we'll finally see what's really in it. But at this point, he's waiting to see. Senator Murkowski's folks, I talked to her spokesman on the Energy Committee, said, you know, while Reid and the Democrats have pulled in some of the ideas that Murkowski actually put forth relating to the oil legislation dealing with BP, they're on the fence here. They need to go through this and make sure they understand everything in the bill, and they're also pointing the finger again about this specter of increasing the deficit, which, of course, is a big Republican cry around here these days. And they, of course, also wanted to see a different kind of energy bill because Murkowski was part of the team on the Energy Committee that had this energy bill, not a climate change bill, but an energy bill last year that included things like nuclear power. Well, that stuff's just not on the table right now. And so there's a lot of sort of defeatist disappointment among liberal Democrats and environmentalists as they see the Democratic Party in the Senate have to just scale everything back.
Right. And we have previously seen Senator Murkowski say that she would oppose the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. And that's headed for a vote, I believe, you can correct me here, toward the end of August or at least before the session ends. Where does that stand?
Right. We'll see that happen in just a couple of weeks before they leave for the August recess. Yeah, all the Republicans except for two have said at this point that they're against the supporting Kagan. We have not heard from Senator Begich how he's going to fall in on this. I checked in with his staff today, and they said he hasn't said yet. But when he met with Kagan last month, and just sort of one of these meet and greets, he said that she actually expressed support for the Second Amendment or gun rights, and also had sympathy for the situation of the Alaskans who were hurt by the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And then you'll remember they had to wait so many years for litigation to wrap up, and then felt, frankly, mistreated by the Supreme Court. So Begich so far has sounded like he's going to support her, but we'll wait and see. This is going to come down along party lines, and this is another chance for Murkowski to show folks back in Alaska that she is not a rhino. She's not a Republican in name only. She is a Republican, and so she'll stand with her party on this.
Okay. And Lori, we also had this week the National Tribal Law and Order Bill. Tell us a little bit about that and what its significance is to Alaska.
Yes, the Tribal Law and Order Act was finally passed. It's been kind of bandied about for about a year. And Libby has certainly put a lot of work in on reporting on this, and she and I have sort of tag-teamed it from time to time. There's the majority of it relates to lower 48 tribes and reservations, but it also has some significance for Alaska in two ways: VPSOs and also study of sexual assault and crime in villages. The VPSOs in Alaska, the village public safety officers, tribal communities and the state will be able now to apply for community-oriented policing, COPS grants, federal grants to help support VPSOs, from everything to office supplies and heating and phone expense to training. They'll also be able to attend the BIA training school for tribal police in New Mexico. The COPS funding is actually reinstated because it was in place up until the early, I think 2003 was when it got cut, and Libby can correct me if I'm wrong about that time. So that's sort of a reinstatement of this. The interesting thing about what happened with this legislation is that it started out with some really comprehensive ideas for Alaska. There was a proposal for a pilot project that would have created sort of these boundary zones around certain communities where tribal courts would have had greatly increased authority to prosecute crimes. And the state objected to that because they were concerned about expanding the concept of tribal sovereignty. And so the state sent a very strongly worded letter saying, you know, this will be immediately litigated and we can't support this. There was a lot of back and forth about it. Eventually, all of that was stripped out of the final bill, and the bill was left with the funding for VPSOs and funding for the study of sexual assault and how those cases are handled in villages, and the desire to provide more training so that when they're gathering forensics evidence, they can make sure that they do it properly so these cases can be prosecuted. However, this is only an authorization. It's not an authorization. I'm sorry. It is an authorization. It's not an appropriation. So whether or not there will eventually be money for it still remains to be seen.
So Libby, this had some controversy to it. How is our delegation feeling about what they were able to procure for the state once it was finally signed?
Yeah, they all supported it. And Murkowski, since she's on the Indian Affairs Committee, her staff were the ones that were really trying to get these things that Lori laid out in the bill. And I think it was very disappointing for them that for her and the team that this $50 million pilot project was yanked out. And it's interesting to note that it was a fellow Republican of hers who said, you can't include that in there. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma called it an earmark, and he held up the entire national bill until that Alaska authorization was yanked out. And Murkowski says, look, this isn't an earmark. The folks in Alaska and rural law enforcement face these unique challenges. It's not like Indian country and reservation lands in the lower 48, and we have to make some accommodations and help them out, but it wouldn't fly. And so they're going to have to try to find other ways to get that put back in there. But as Lori said, you know, it's just one little slice that affects Alaska, this much broader big bill.
Okay. We'll close out here on some different topics later. Perhaps a big issue earlier this summer was whether or not Mayor Dan Sullivan should close a city trail in a park that's known to be an existing bear habitat. We had some problems there last year with some attacks, I believe, on a jogger and a bicyclist. And then this week, We got a picture that made it very clear exactly what the problem was and remains, in case anybody had any question that there might be a very real threat there. Steve, what came up? What did cameras catch?
That camera, that the camera that's mounted on the Rover's Run Trail showed a mama bear, brown bear, good-sized brown bear, trailed by three good-sized babies, too.
Like two-year-old babies.
Yeah,
these are not itty-bitty bear babies.
This spring's cubs by any stretch. No, these were pretty formative bears, formidable bears, big bears. And all you could do, I don't know how many times I've heard from people who said, can you imagine riding your bike down the hill and meeting this head-on, or going around the corner on a walk or a hike and seeing this scene? But, yeah, that, you know, talk about pictures saying 1,000 words, that was it right then and there. You know who runs the trail out there.
And the mayor's office put this out saying, right, look, hey, we weren't kidding. I mean, that's my paraphrase. But they put out the picture, and they put out the warnings again about how to properly commute in bear country. Is that enough? I mean, has this reinvigorated the debate about whether or not it's appropriate to keep that open or close it?
It certainly is. It's better than any kind of bear warning sign, that's for certain. You know, and I think it really illustrates people, you know, Alaskans need to know how to be bear aware, as they say. And yeah, you can run into bears any part of this in any part of this town. So you always have to be prepared.
Okay, thanks, Steve. That's all the time we have for this week's edition of Anchorage Edition. Thanks for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org, or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.